This is David Clark, and I'm the host of Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we'll be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. Now, I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite all our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. Each week, we will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now, this is a no-holds-barred show, so it's not going to pull any punches, folks. My guests are going to have different spiritual belief systems, and some will have none. So you may or may not agree with things that are said. What I would ask you to do is to keep an open mind. By doing this, you can find where you can find that common ground and relate rather than compare yourself to others. As for me, I'm spiritually eclectic in nature. I was raised in a traditional Protestant church, but I pulled away from the church for 30 years after I'd come out as a gay man because I didn't feel welcome and I didn't particularly appreciate being called a sinner simply because I was born gay. I do believe in reincarnation and that we're all ultimately responsible for ourselves. This latter understanding comes from over 25 years of recovery experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that we create our own heaven or hell. Over the years, I have evolved spiritually and have finally found a church that embraces my own belief systems, and that is that all religions and spiritual beliefs serve a higher purpose and that we are all basically one. So I believe. Now, tonight, I have a special guest. She just happens to be the minister of my Unity Church, and her name is Edith Washington. And in just a minute, I'm going to read her biography and introduce her to you. Just to let you know a little bit about the show, next week we're going to have Johnny G, who's a nationally renowned interior designer and a recovering sex addict, and he's going to talk about how God has changed his life and turned him into a loving, attentive, faithful husband after a life of philandering. And the week after that, I have a very eclectic spiritual adventurer by the name of Regina Du, and she is a Catholic who uses Sufism in order to find Jesus. And she's had a very varied career, and it will be a wonderful show. Now, as for me, as you may or may not know, I'm an author, and with Christmas coming, I'd like to put in a plug for my books. My latest book is called Shades of Gay, written by David Clark. That's spelled Clark with an E, and you can find that on Amazon.com. It's about a recovering alcoholic and sex addict who comes to discover that he needs to make a decision on whether to just enjoy the cheap and shallow thrills of the moment or go for something that's more permanent and fulfilling. And it's received rave reviews on Amazon.com. The other books are written under a pen name. You don't need to remember the name. It's Davis Ojerdwe. But those books are entitled The Misadventures of Sister Mary Olga Fortitude and Babes in Bucksnort. And they're about a naughty nun who likes her bourbon and her Marlboros, the Reverend Mother's a reformed prostitute, the convent chef is a gay cowboy, and all the characters are deliciously dysfunctional and guaranteed to give you a laugh. And what I've been working on this week is actually the 13th book in the series, so I've got a few more to get out, folks. At any rate, now I want to introduce via biography Reverend Edith Washington. She was licensed and ordained by Unity Worldwide Ministries in June 2009. She holds a Master's of Divinity degree from Unity Institute and Seminary located in Unity Village, Missouri. She has a Bachelor of Liberal Arts degree and has been a licensed electrician for 19 years. In fact, she was the first African-American woman to become a licensed electrician in the state of Minnesota. She's also a certified practitioner in the healing art of touch therapy. She continuously participates in personal and professional courses that improve her communication skills, leadership abilities, and her capacity to develop and empower effective, heart-centered leaders. She has a daily prayer and meditation practice, which includes prayer partners from a variety of faith traditions. Reverend Edith has a background of service in anti-violence advocacy, addiction recovery groups, and penal institutions. She has a passion for connecting with people outside of Unity, whether it's with youth in the schools or with the interfaith community in which she's very involved locally in Syracuse. Reverend Edith is a lifelong learner, and she's committed to being of service to others. And so I would like to welcome Reverend Edith Washington. How are you tonight, Reverend?
Hi, I'm fine. How are you, David?
I'm great. I'm so glad to hear your voice. It's always such a pleasure.
Yeah.
I wondered, in light of the passing of Nelson Mandela, if you would care to share some thoughts with our audience, just to hold him in a sacred space tonight.
Well, you know, some of the things that I have been hearing about Nelson Mandela is that he changed the world. He changed the world in seeing that we could all live in this world together. I have a quote that I found that I think is fitting to the nature of this particular program and who we are as spiritual, that we're having a spirit, we're human beings having a spiritual experience. And here's the quote that he said. No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion. People must learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for that. We are going to share with the audience Unity's word for the day, and I think it would be best to do that at the end of this, the interview, just so that people can take that in, because they're probably drinking in what you just said. So I would like to start asking you some questions, if you're ready for it.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Can you tell us what your religious and spiritual background was like?
What it looked like when I was growing up?
Yes.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I was born into a mixed family. And what I mean by that is my mom's side of the family were Catholic. My dad's side of the family was Baptist. Now, they both were African-American people, but it was a huge, 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 huge thing for them to be from two different kinds of religions.
Mm.
And because of that, I thought I was going to go sit in purgatory for a couple of million, a billion years.
That oh,
I
boy.
Was from birth, you know. You know, there were some things that were told to my dad. He had to go to classes. The Catholic Church required him to, and he did the classes, and it was a lot of, I'm going to use the word hate, you know, hateful kind of things that was said to him just based on the fact that he was not in the religion that was the same as my mom being a Catholic. And eventually, though, we were able to get baptized. I got baptized as a I don't know, I think maybe I was 3 or 4, but it took that long before we were allowed to. And so, yeah, that's how it started out for me.
Was it confusing for you to have those two different religious practices between your parents?
The only confusing part about it is, my grandmother on my dad's side used to sneak us to the Baptist church every now and then. And part about it is that they would get dunked when they got baptized, and I didn't, and I wanted to. was really confusing. I guess as a kid, you know, children are really resilient, and I never really noticed the difference at that time other than that. Now that I'm thinking about it, well, when I was in Catholicism as a child, the masses were in Latin, and, they had incense and things like that, and I had my rosary and all those kinds of things, whereas in the Baptist religion, I remember that people used to pass out a lot, and I thought that was quite
Well, you're dating yourself by going back to Latin there, Edith.
53 years old, and so in the 60s, you know, in when I was growing up, that was how it was. And so
yeah.
I don't know when things happened. All I know is now looking back on it, I really liked it being in Latin, and I liked that whole pomp and circumstance kind of way that Catholic upbringing brought me when I was a child.
Yes, but what kind of understanding were you able to discern from the masses being in Latin and not in your native tongue?
I went to Catholic school, so I'm sure that they, figured out a way for us to get whatever we want. Because let me back up. When I was in the third grade, I did get my first Holy Communion, so I'm sure we had classes and things like that. We went to Mass every Friday and then turned around again and went on Sunday. So I'm sure that I got something. I just don't remember much other than the rosary and the prayers. I really like that part of it.
Yeah. Well, let's make it clear to the audience, you're not a practicing Catholic today. You're a Unity minister. Can you tell me what parts of your Catholic roots you may have hung on to over the years, if any?
Well, there are a couple of things. One thing I noticed when I was in seminary at Unity Village, in seminary for becoming a minister, is I realized that there were parts of the Catholic religion, or at least pieces of it, that I really liked. And one of them was the fact that the masses were in Latin. When I was in high school, I took 3 years of Latin. I graduated in 3 years, so I didn't do the fourth year, but all the time I was in high school, I took Latin, and I never realized that maybe the Latin masses somehow influenced me to make that decision, because no one made that. I made that decision of my own self. Nobody said, take this or take that. I wanted to take Latin, and I did.
Well, good for you. And it sounds like you were very precocious going through school on 3 years. I did that with college, and it was quite a challenge, but I just was a very dedicated student, as I trust you were, and I wanted to go on to graduate school, but that's another story. Enough about that. Let's get into the nitty-gritty, because you have a background that has been colored by a lot of pain and addiction. I'm wondering if you can tell me what kind of impact your broken family of origin household had on you, because I know that your parents became divorced.
My parents were divorced, I think I was around 8 years old, to my best guess. And in my little child's mind, I made it mean that I did something wrong and it was my fault.
Mm. That's what children do.
Yep.
And what did you do with that?
Well, I already had been thinking I was a bad little girl anyway, just, going back to the whole Catholicism Baptist part, And then I was sexually molested when I was probably around 5, and so then I made that my fault too. And so I had a series of things that happened at an early age that I just made up that there was obviously something wrong with me and that I was a bad little girl. And I carried it with me for decades.
I bet. Were you conscious of the sexual abuse, or did you have an out-of-body experience when that happened?
I had out-of-body experiences. It happened more than once over a number of years.
And what do you...
Yes.
Go ahead.
And
no,
I
go ahead.
I didn't know until my early 40s that that was what that was, that I had disconnected or disassociated with my body at that time. And now, of course, looking back, I remember hearing about people who did that kind of thing, you know, like people with multiple personalities and the like, but yet there were people who functioned pretty normally who could disconnect from their body and disconnect from their emotions. And so in disconnecting, I became comfortable with covering up feelings, whether it was totally being outside of my body in a sense or covering it up with some kind of an addictive process.
And how did you do that as a child?
Well, when those things were happening to me, it was like I wasn't really there in a sense.
I see. I just wondered if there were any other things. I know you got into addiction later in your life, but I wondered if there were any coping mechanisms that could be viewed as addictive or whatever that you used to soothe yourself with as a child.
One thing that I did that was repetitious was I rocked my body or I shook my leg and did it for a number of years. And sometimes I can notice I'll do it every now and then, but I used to do it a lot.
You were taking care of little Edith?
Yep.
Well, now, you said that when you came to your 40s, early 40s, that's when the memories came back for you?
When the memories came back. It was when I got sober from alcohol and opiate addiction was when I got the definition of that that's what that was with the molestation. And I had buried it. But it took longer than that for me to connect with my actual, like, that I was having these experiences with intimacy where I would disassociate and I would not, like, be able to feel any. I just basically, it was like I wasn't there. And I can't.
Are you talking about intimacy, physical intimacy with other people as an adult?
Yep. For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, well, I can relate to that, absolutely. Have you been able to forgive your perpetrator?
Yes.
How did you do that?
A lot of work through the 12 steps, through therapy, coaches, a lot of different things. Just a lot of personal work on that matter, and it wasn't just the perpetrator, because there have been a number of various types of perpetrators in my life, so it was all of them. And what I really get about forgiveness is when I'm holding on to a resentment or unforgiveness, it's kind of like I'm drinking poison expecting the other person to die.
Yeah, and the only person that you hurt is yourself.
I
know that you became a mother very early. Can you talk a little bit about your experience as being a teen mother?
Well, the first time that that I was pregnant, I was probably, I don't know if I was 14 or 15. I think I was 15. Like, I had just turned 15, I think. Or either I was getting ready to turn 15. And then, you know what? I'm sure I was 14. And then by the time that the way that I didn't have this kid happened, I had turned 15 in the process. And then 6 weeks later, I was pregnant again.
Do you think that you became sexualized at such a young age because you had been sexually molested?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because when
well,
something like that happens to a child has no no way to identify. So for me, what I made it mean was sex equals love.
Yes.
And so if I had, you know, someone that liked me or I thought they liked me or something like that, then the first reaction was to do that action needed to happen based on how I defined it as a little girl. And so it was very promiscuous, and no one knew it because it was a secret. And then when the pregnancies happened, nobody talked to me about it or anything. It was just, you know, in my neighborhood, they called it, you're being fast, F-A-S-T.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard that term before. It was around when I was a kid. We're about the same age. Well, I'd like to move on a little bit because I really would like for you to share with the audience something about your addiction and recovery story, because I've heard parts of it, and it's very powerful. And so perhaps we could spend about 5 minutes on that, because I do have a lot of questions I would like to ask you. And I really want to get into your experience with Unity, what that's about, your ministry, your calling, and all of that. So if you'd be kind enough to indulge me and our audience, would you tell us your story?
Okay, so my story with addiction started when I was a child. I believe I was around seven or eight, and I don't remember exactly when, but it was definitely before I was age 10. And my dad used to give me this thing that he liked to drink. You know, some people who are adults don't mind giving children liquor. And I remember liking the way it tasted and what it felt like going. And then I remember at the reception with him and his current wife, whom he's been married to since, I think, 1969, I remember they gave me champagne and stuff. You know, and I remember the fountain and filling up my cup. Addictive process started then. And then as I got older, it progressed, and I would sneak and get a drink here and there and whatever. And I was off to the races as a kid. And by the time I got to high school at age 14, I was already, you know, drinking and smoking marijuana and stuff like that. And so it just continued from there.
Now, you talked about opiates earlier. When did you get into that, and what kinds of consequences did you experience from drugs and alcohol that had a negative impact on you?
I started using drugs when I was, I started with marijuana before high school. I don't know exactly when, but for sure by the time I was in the ninth grade, I was using marijuana and then acid. You know, acid was out then in the 70s and 60s and stuff,
sure.
So I used to do that thing. And by the time I was, in my later teens, before high school was up, so maybe 16, 17 years old, I was doing diet pills. That was, you know, they call them amphetamines and speed or whatever, so I did that. And then by the time I was 19, that was when the opiates started.
And what do you mean by opiates? Some people might not know what that is.
Okay, so heroin, prescription or none, you know, what should be prescription opiates, but, you know, I wasn't prescribed them.
Okay.
So that's what I mean. Yeah. It was a total package. It was all of the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah. When did your world come crashing down? What was your bottom?
I had lots of bottoms.
Okay. Well, tell us about a few of them.
Well, I would say some of my bottoms would be when I was homeless. And especially homeless with my twins. And I had been homeless with my twins, and I was an addict. And I remember one time I had pneumonia in 1989, And I passed out, and the paramedics came, and they looked at my arms and saw the needle marks, and they thought that I had OD'd. And the police came and took the babies and took us all to jail.
Oh, my.
And my mom got the twins, and I went off to jail. And then I was really sick. I was had vomiting blood. And so when they took me to the hospital, they knew I had pneumonia. And so that was a type of a bottom, but I still wasn't ready yet.
What was your biggest bottom, and what brought you into recovery?
That started me on a journey when that happened, because they took my kids, and I had to fight to get them back. And then I left Los Angeles, and I had gone to a church. I used to walk with the children down in Los Angeles when I lived there, and I went to a church, and I asked them, I said, if you could help me leave and go back to my hometown in Gary, Indiana, you don't have to give me any money. If you could see to purchase a plane ticket. And I went over to my mom's, and later that evening they called me and they said, we have your plane ticket. And
oh, wonderful.
Back to Indiana, me and the babies. And it's a longer story, but ultimately I ended up in Minnesota running from an abusive man who I latched on to because I didn't want to be ostracized for being gay, and he knew what to get better heroin than my uncle. And
when
so
did
I
you realize?
Hmm?
When did you realize you were gay?
Probably, for sure, I think I was 17 or 18.
Okay. So you had your babies and were with other men in spite of knowing that you were gay. And,
yeah, but I was trying to deny it. I was not going to be that. And then I think I was about 20 or 21 when I knew, and I came out to my mom and my uncle, and they just, you know, really made me feel very, very bad. And so when I went back to Indiana, I didn't want to feel bad like that anymore.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. And I can relate to the struggle. Things were a lot different back then. There were no support systems. It was hard for me. I didn't know any gay people in my growing up years. There wasn't anybody I felt safe going to tell them my big dark secret, and I didn't want to be that way because everything I'd heard about gay people was negative, and that wasn't who I thought I was. And yet deep down inside, I knew I was gay, and I thought, I'm going to go to hell because that's what I've been told. And so, you know, I can relate to the struggle. I'm wondering what kinds of challenges you may have had accepting God in your life.
What kind of challenges did you say?
Yes.
Well, because of when I came out, my uncle, whom died from AIDS, by the way, from IV drug use, he took me on a long, dark ride and told me it was morally wrong. So then, you know, I had this whole thing about, well, okay, so I'm bad. Remember I said I was a bad little girl from the time I was little. So this was just more confirmation of it. And then I didn't want to have anything to do with God or anything, unless, of course, I was having something bad happen to me. Then I would pray to God, please help me and all that kind of thing. When I got sober, I knew I had a spiritual experience that something happened. And then I could look back in my life and notice when it had happened at other times.
Ah.
And so when my spirituality took a turn was then.
Ah. Well, let's get into that a little bit later. I'm wondering how the recovering Edith Reverend Edith, is different than the addict was?
The addict Edith didn't know that she was worthy of anything. The addict Edith thought that she was unlovable, bad, would always be bad, and would never measure up to other people.
What messages of hope can you put out to people who might be listening who have been in denial about their addictions but could relate to these feelings of being quote-unquote bad, not worthy, unlovable? What could you say to people like that to give them hope?
Okay, before I say that, I have to also say that the only emotion I knew was anger.
So in addition
to feeling unlovable, unwanted, never measuring up, the emotion of being angry, because the other emotions couldn't surface, they were buried. It was not okay to feel emotions, because then you were vulnerable, or you were, you know, people could get you if you show your emotions. Somebody might hurt you, rather.
Right.
And so
I know what you mean.
The message of hope that I could give is that all that stuff is not true.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely not true.
Mm-hmm.
That each one of us were created as what I call spiritual beings, having a human experience, having a spiritual experience.
I like that tag on that you do. Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, unfortunately, a lot of people may not be able to relate to the having a spiritual experience. And I'd like to say, folks, that that's possible for any of you. All you need to do is turn yourself around and start with something as simple as looking at a sunrise or a sunset and experience that feeling of awe that comes into you. Or if you have children or pets, just get in touch with the feeling that you have when you're around them, that love that comes to you, that unconditional love that you may not be feeling in other areas of your life. There are a lot of ways to get in touch with your spirit and have little spiritual experiences that can turn into very profound ones. What areas of your life do you still think you need healing, Edith?
Well, it's a work in progress.
Right.
It's a continuous work in progress. One of the things we talk about in Unity, we have these five basic principles, and the fifth one is that you have to practice it. And so for me, what I found is that I don't arrive in the same way that I don't arrive as being recovered, being, you know, even though I've been in recovery for 19 years, I'm not recovered. I continuously go to meetings, you know, talk with sponsors and all that kind of thing, because in a half of a second, I could be out there drinking or boozing or whatever. In the same way with my thoughts. See, my thoughts can say to me at any time, you know, you remember long time ago, you weren't nothing, you'll never be nothing. Somebody told you that, or you told yourself. And so I have to continually practice saying the words, the positive words of, you are okay the way you are, and it's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong. And for people who don't believe in a spiritual experience and all of that, that's okay. The main thing is to know that you're okay right in the skin you're in. Otherwise, why would we be born anyway? And that it doesn't matter the things we've done to people, the things we've done to ourselves, it doesn't matter. We're okay in the skin that we're in, and that things can always, always get better if we want
right.
them to.
Right, right. That's a key word, is that desire is so important and has been so important in my life. And you touched on something that also is very important to me, and that is affirmations. Would you speak a little bit about affirmations, what they are, and what kind of power they can have for somebody, and maybe give some examples in the I statement of some affirmations that might be useful to other people, maybe one or two.
Okay. So affirmations are affirmative words of truth, whether we are experiencing that as truth or not. The affirmations help us to condition our mind and our thinking to what it is that we are or want to see for ourselves. So, for instance, if I want to experience love, then I could just say, I am love, or I am experiencing love, or I am surrounded by love, for instance. And just the mere repeating of it over time, the body responds to that. It's kind of like an energy. When you know someone is upset and angry, they have a certain energy or vibration, if you will, that feels like you could cut it with the air with a knife. It's really thick. When you see someone that is full of light, full of hope, full of peace, they carry a certain kind of an energy or vibrational level, too. And I'm going to use Nelson Mandela as an example of that. You know,
good example.
I mean, everyone who has heard anything about that man would say that he had a lot of light, a lot of love, and a lot of hope. And so that's why the outpouring of words that have come across the globe have happened because of who he was being. And so we practice it. It's not to say that he was always like that, because they said that he was very angry at one point in his life about apartheid and stuff like that. But we evolve from the things that we go through. We actually grow through them, G-R-O-W. And so in growing affirmative words, then we create these I statements, I am peace, I am this, you know, pain doesn't have any power over me. We may have pain going on, because pain happens sometimes, but I am free and unlimited. So it's those kinds of things. Does that help?
Absolutely. And I'll share with the audience who may not be aware, if they haven't listened to my previous shows, I'm a recovering person too, a recovering alcoholic, recovering drug addict, and recovering sex addict. And I too have shared a lot of these feelings of unworthiness or labeling myself as bad. And one of the keys to me becoming to a place where I feel good about myself has been to use affirmations. That has been such a big thing, and it's something that's big within the church that we belong to, Unity Church, but anybody can use it. It's very simple, and I would encourage people that are out there to write their own affirmations, because they'll have more power for you. If you pick those qualities you wish to possess, even if it's just in your wildest dreams, pick a few qualities that you want to possess, and write it down, and then say it out loud, and say it like you believe it, and claim that quality for you in the here and now, and it will manifest, I guarantee it. But practice makes perfect, and if you don't practice it, you're not going to get anywhere. What would you say about that, Reverend Edith? Are you still with me, Reverend Edith?
Oh, I put you on mute.
Oh, okay.
So,
you didn't want to hear me sermonizing, huh?
No, I didn't want you to hear me clicking.
Oh,
so
okay. Did you hear what
me.
I said?
I did.
Okay.
And so the practice of it makes more perfect, in my opinion, because when it's not the destination that we're trying to get to, it's the journey.
Right.
It's all about the journey. I used to think, I'm in a food recovery also, and I used to think when I get to a certain size, then I would arrive, and I get to that size, and then I end up eating again.
That's a tough addiction too. Well, you know, I use that expression because that's something that my piano teacher taught me, And of course, we're all human beings, and as such, we're not perfect. And chances are we're not going to make it there. I mean, there haven't been too many Jesus Christ that have walked this planet. I only know of one. But the point is that we can make progress, and we can aim for a mark. And the important thing I have found is to not use that mark as a whipping, something to whip yourself by or beat yourself up by. It's so important to be gentle with yourself, but aim high. There's no reason that you can't aim high and come to realize something that's closer to perfection and not beat yourself up if you don't make it to perfection, because we're not perfect, folks. We're human beings. Well, would you tell us a little bit about your various careers? You've had a very interesting background.
That's true. Well, yeah. Let's see. So, being an electrician, I've been at, 2013. Have I been one 20 years now? I don't know. I can't keep up. Okay, so I think I'm in my 20th year. And it's been an amazing career. I'm not actively practicing it like out on a job, obviously, being a senior minister at a church, but it brought me a whole lot it helped with my self-esteem. It helped me to start looking at that I was worthy, even though throughout quite a bit of that career I was in my process of recovery from believing that I wasn't good enough. But it wasn't easy because, you know, going into an arena that is mostly white and mostly male brought up a lot of that not good enough stuff. So it wasn't easy in those regards, and yet I was determined. It was something in me that had to have that. And so I don't know how I did it other than the Spirit of God flowing through me and around me helped me to see myself to complete that task of becoming an electrician.
Well, just in case people are just tuning in, Reverend Edith has the distinction of being or having been the first African-American woman in the state of Minnesota who was an electrician. And I'm wondering what it was like for you, just to get into it a little more, what it was like for you to be in that position in a male-identified profession, if there were any conflicts for you or challenges.
I used to think because I had this double minority that it would be easy for me to get jobs, and it wasn't. It might be easy to get jobs, but I would be like the first laid off. And so I got laid off a lot. And people did things that weren't nice, like walking up behind me and touching my hair, for instance. And that was before I had dreadlocks. I used to wear my hair in braids a lot, you know, how African-American women wear their hair in braids. And they would just come up and do stuff like that. And so it was, you know, things that were done that wasn't nice. And I wasn't the first African-American woman to go through, like, an apprenticeship program or whatever. I was the first one to actually complete it without quitting, and then take the test and pass it. There were others who had come before me that did either, they might complete the course, the apprenticeship program, but then couldn't pass the test. And so I was the first one to do both. And it was definitely something that I keep my license because it took a lot to get it.
I don't blame you for doing that. Let's move forward a little bit in time. Tell us what brought you to Unity Church. What attracted you?
My sponsor. She used to make me do stuff.
Okay.
You know, she makes stuff.
I've got one
she
of those, too.
So there were two profound instances that she did make me do stuff. And one was the fourth step, which is where you write down inventory. And the second one was asking me to come visit the church she had been attending. And you know, eventually I did the fourth step the way she wanted me to, which was the way it's done in the Big Book. And the profound part of that was when I discovered the sexual molestation. When I was doing it my way, it wasn't coming out. I wasn't going back that far. I didn't think I needed to. And so when I did it that way, it came up, and it was very scary and frightening. And again, I tried to make it my fault, but I had sponsors and grand sponsors who would tell me, no, you were a kid. It wasn't your fault. And then the second thing was she invited me here to the church she had been attending. She hadn't attended it long, because not during my whole time in recovery with her had she, but finally she found unity, and I finally listened, because she kept bugging the heck out of me. And once I went, myself and my children loved it more than I did initially, and yet I got it, and we never stopped coming, and I've been doing it ever since. And that sponsor, I think within 2 years, two or three years after she had introduced me to Unity, she passed, and she passed away in 2000. Yeah.
Oh. Well, just to let people in the audience who aren't 12-steppers know, everybody that comes into a 12-step program is encouraged to have a sponsor, and that is a one-on-one relationship with somebody who helps guide you through your recovery process and the 12 steps. And the fourth step that Reverend Edith was just referring to is basically taking a look at the pluses and minuses of yourself. It's taking a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself and really getting to know who you are. And then once that's done, a fifth step is done where you admit that those things to yourself, to God, and to another human being, which quite often is a sponsor. So can you tell me what's different about Unity Church from other Christian practices?
When I first went to, when I got sober, I knew that I had a spiritual experience, so I went to a traditional church, and it was a lot of words like sinner, not words. And that kind of thing. And I discarded that because I had a spiritual experience. And yet, after being in that arena for a little while, I realized that it just wasn't working for me. And I stopped going. And then the sponsor told me about it. So the difference between Unity and Christian churches would be that we are a positive, practical approach to Christianity, or even you can even go so far to say a positive, practical way of living or spirituality, because we are culturally Christian but spiritually unlimited in Unity. You might hear me reading from the Bible, but I might have quotes or whatnot from the Dalai Lama or Buddhism or some other spiritual tradition, is very comfortable with sharing other spiritual traditions within what we do in Unity.
I love that very much. When and how did you receive your religious calling?
In August 2003 at about 2:35 in the morning.
Tell us about it.
I was sleeping, and I woke up, and I remember having this knowing, you know, you're to be a minister, or you're going to be a minister, or something like that. And I remember it was kind of like wrestling, like Job in the Bible wrestled with the angels. And I remember having this, you know, thoughts going on in my head, like, you're not worthy to do that. And it was some word, the names, preacher, reverend, pastor, minister, all of those words were going through my head at that time. And I don't know which one of them was the one, but one of them made me feel very uncomfortable with the thoughts of not being worthy, not being good enough, not measuring up. And how could I possibly do something like that with the life I've lived, blah, blah, blah. And finally, I was already a meditator at that time. And so I just went into a meditation. I didn't know what else to do because I was in such turmoil. And I remember saying, okay, so if this is what you want me to do, lead me and guide me. And then I went back to sleep, and that was it. And then that's what happened. I was led and guided. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't an easy experience. All kinds of things happened. Lots and lots of things happened along the way on this journey. And yet I was continuing to study and to practice and, you know, taking classes in Unity and that kind of thing.
Well, thank you. I have a question for you about how you can relate to people who have a literal interpretation of the Bible, because in Unity we take more of a metaphorical approach to the Bible. We discern truths that are in there, but we don't take it word for word.
Well, there are people who believe that every single word in the Bible is true always. And if we look at the historical piece of the Bible alone, we can look at the fact that the people who were there writing, because we can say that the Bible was inspired by God, and yet it was written by man. However, there are things in there that are inspirational, but if we looked at the time that it was written, the people back then, over 2,000 years ago, or around 2,000 years ago, they thought that the earth was flat. They thought that there was a dome up in the sky, that God lived above the dome, and that, you know, they couldn't even conceive that the world was round. And so just in their worldview at the time, they made up some things that we know that is just not true today.
Right.
So within the Bible, if we look at it from that perspective, then there are pieces of it that just don't fit for us. And it doesn't make it wrong. It doesn't make it that it didn't, you know, happen in their time. But for us to fit that world into our world, it's just an interesting thing, that's all. I'm not going to make it wrong that people believe that every word is true. I just know for sure, as a theologian, that it just isn't possible, really, if you really look at it from that perspective. And the various things that were being done at that time, you know, people conquered people a lot. They had slaves. Women were, you know, almost to be seen and not heard. Children were used for manual labor from the time they were born. You know, in our world, in the Western world, it's unheard of. Yet there are places in the world where that's still going on. And so for us, in Unity, we look at it like, how can we utilize the Bible to have us live better lives? How can I look at the characters in the Bible and say, when am I having a Job experience, like I was talking about wrestling with the angels? When am I wrestling with myself? When am I wrestling with my thoughts? You know, when I release and let that go.
Well, thank you. I have just a couple more questions I'd like to ask you, and then I think we will close with a word for the day. There should be time for that. Just if you could give me quick answers to these questions. What would you say to people who have little or no faith?
I would say to people who have little or no faith, it's okay to not believe. You know, people can believe whatever they want. They can choose to think whatever they want. But if there is something that's missing or you feel is missing in your life, you might want to just try it out. Try out a spirituality kind of thing, like a connection with something that may be unseen. There are things that we can't see, like the air we breathe, for instance, and yet we know that it's there. electricity, for instance, we can't see it, but we know when we turn the light on, the light comes on. And so these are proven laws. Spirituality and a spiritual essence isn't necessarily provable, but yet there are people who are changed by prayer, people who are changed by meditation and peacefulness. And so if one just takes on choosing peace, for instance, as a way of being, then the world will be a better place.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. Would you be willing to read the daily word for today, which is synchronicity?
Yes, I will.
And it's
interesting that the word synchronicity comes up today when we are remembering Nelson Mandela. So we'll remember him, the word for today being synchronicity. And the affirmation for today is divine love is continually revealing itself to me. Divine love is continually revealing itself to me. And the reading for today is as follows. As I align my heart and mind with spirit, I become increasingly aware of amazing events in my life that might be called happy coincidences. Perhaps an old friend calls unexpectedly and tells me exactly what I need to know for an important assignment. Or maybe I meet someone special at an event I hesitated to attend. I am grateful for divine synchronicities. They remind me that I am connected to everyone and everything. Aware of my kinship with all of life, I feel immense love and joy. Nothing happens by chance. All is in divine order. Synchronicities may be viewed as glimpses of divine love's presence, which brightens my day and illumines my way. And from the book of Romans 8:28, it says, we know that all things work together for good for those who love God. The word for
thank
today.
Thank you, Reverend.
You're welcome, David, and thank you.
And, well, I just have one more question for you, and I'm going to challenge you to put it in one sentence. What's your primary purpose for today?
To give and receive unconditional love.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Reverend Edith. It's really been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Okay, well, once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.